It took us a while to get out of there. Too much was going on. I rolled up the page and stuck it inside my bolt. Ayla picked up the bunch of flowers. This reminded me of why I'd come up here in the first place and of what we had been doing before Ayla had noticed the sparks. I felt like a jerk for letting this slip my mind. By that time, though, Ayla had remembered about the Sant Chandra's bane and was wondering what to do with it. So we traded. I gave her the chart, and she gave me the flowers so that I could accept the risk of sneaking them back down. What should we do next? I wondered out loud. About... We had opened the trap door. There was plenty of light. I was about to blurt what we just saw when I noticed a look on her face, steeling herself to get hurt again. I think I stopped myself just in time.
Do you want to... should we...
I began, then closed my eyes and just said it. I think we should be honest about this in front of everyone.
I'm fine with that,
she said.
I'll set it up for tomorrow, I guess, after Provener.
I'll tell Tullia, she said. Who do you want as your witness?
I had been about to say Leo, but Jessery had been such a jerk about this that I decided he had to be the one.
And our free witness can just be Halagastrim or whoever is handy, I said.
What kind of liaison are we to publish? She asked.
This was not a difficult question. Liaisons were supposed to be announced when they were formed and when they were dissolved. It was a way to curtail gossip and intrigue, which could so easily run rampant in a math. The consent of Sant Edhar recognized several types. The least serious was Tivian. The most serious, Paralithian, was equivalent to marriage. That was out of the question for two kids of our age who had hated each other's guts until 45 minutes ago. If I said Tivian, Ayla would throw me out the trap door to my death, and I'd spend the last 4 seconds of my life wishing I had said Etrivanian.
Could you stand having people know that you were in an Etrivanian liaison with that big jerk Fra Erasmus?
She smiled.
Yes.
Okay. Then awkwardness.
It seemed appropriate to kiss her one more time. This went over well.
Now, are we going to talk about the fact that we have just discovered an alien spacecraft hiding in orbit around Arb?
She asked in a tiny, coy voice. Most unlike her. But she wasn't as used to being in big trouble as I was, and so I think she felt as though, on such questions, she had to defer to a hardened criminal. To a few people. I'm pretty sure Leo's down in the Fendant Court. I'll stop there and tell him.
That works. We should go about separately anyway until our liaison is published.
Her agility in jumping between the love topic and the alien spacecraft was making me dizzy. Or perhaps giddy.
So I'll meet you below later. We'll spread the news to the others as we have opportunity.
Bye,
she said.
Don't forget your forbidden flower.
I won't, I said. Just like that, she was gone down the ladder. I followed a minute later and found Leo in a chamber in the Fendant Court. He was studying a book about a Praxic Age battle that had been conducted in the abandoned subway tunnels of a great city by two armies that had run out of ammunition and so had to fight with sharpened shovels. He looked at me blankly for a while. I must have looked even blanker. Then I realized that the recent events weren't written on my face. I would actually have to communicate.
Incredible things have happened in the last hour, I announced.
Such as?
I didn't know what to say first, but concluded that alien spaceships were a better topic for the Warden Fendant's reading room. So I gave him a full account of that. He looked a little deranged until I got to the point about how the spark track curved and mentioned plasma. Then his face snapped like a shutter.
I know what it is,
he said. He was so certain that doubting him never crossed my mind. Instead, I just wondered how he knew.
How can you—
I know what it is.
Okay, what is it? For the first time, he took his eyes off mine and let his gaze wander around the reading room.
It might be here, or it might be in the old library. I'll find it. I'll show it to you later.
Why don't you simply tell me?
Because you won't believe me until I show it to you in a book that was written by someone else. That's how weird it is.
Okay, I said.
Then I added, "Congratulations," since that seemed like the right thing to say. Leo slammed his book shut, stood up, turned his back on me, and headed for the stacks. Back at the cloister, I came to understand that things were going to move much more slowly than I wanted them to. I was on supper duty, so I spent the remainder of the afternoon in the kitchen. Ayla and Tullia didn't have to cook, but they did have to serve. While dumping a hot potato into my bowl, Ayla gave me a look that moved me in a way that I won't describe here. While burying it with stew, Tullia gave me a look that proved Ayla had told her everything. "The pinhole. Nice," I told her. Fra Metaxan, who had been nudging me in the kidney with his bowl, trying to get me to move faster, had no idea what I meant and only became more irritated. Leo didn't show up for supper. Jezri was there, but I couldn't talk to him because we were at a crowded table with Barb and several others. Arsibault sat as far from us as he could, as had been his habit of late. After supper, he was on cleanup duty. Jezri went off to a chalk hall to work with some of the other Edharians on a proof. Those guys might work until dawn. But I couldn't have talked to him anyway because I had to corner Fra Heligastrium and set up the little aught tomorrow where Ayla and I would declare our liaison before witnesses and have it entered in the chronicle. I did have time to work out where in the sky the sun had stood at 2 in the afternoon. After curfew, when the Fids had gone to bed, I went out into the meadow alone, sat on a bench and stared at that place in the sky for an hour, hoping I might get lucky and see a satellite pass through. Which was irrational, because if this spaceship could be seen with the naked eye, none of this intrigue would have been necessary. It was some combination of too small, too dark, and or too high to bounce back enough light for our eyes to see it. But I needed to sit there alone for a while and stare into the black just to settle my thoughts. My brain zinged back and forth between the two topics for an hour. When I was totally exhausted, I got up and crawled into a vacant cell where I slept soundly. Leo was in the refectory at breakfast. When I caught his eye, he glanced significantly at a big old book he had dug up. Praxic Age Exoatmospheric Weapons Systems. Cheerful. Jezri skipped breakfast. Afterwards, Ayla and I squandered most of the morning getting things ready for this afternoon. You could announce a Tivian liaison at the drop of a hat, but for the Etravanian, each participant was supposed to discuss it first with an older Fra or Sur. I was finishing that up when Provener rang. This was one of those increasingly rare days when my old team was supposed to wind the clock. I found the cell where Jezri was still asleep, yanked him off his pallet, and got him moving. We ended up sprinting to the Minster, late as usual. But it felt good to have the team back together, after all that had been happening lately, and I enjoyed the simple physical work of winding the clock more than I had used to. After, the four of us went to the refectory to take the midday meal, but there was no question of talking about the spaceship there. Instead, it was all about the aught that Ayla and I were to celebrate later. Of all the team, I was the first to go so far as to join in such a liaison, and so this was sort of like a rehearsal for a bachelor party. We became so loud and so funny, at least we believed we were funny, that we were asked on 2 separate occasions to tone it down and threatened with severe penance, which only made us louder and funnier. At some point during all of this, I mentally stepped back from it all and took a moment to enjoy the looks on my friends' faces and to reflect on everything that had been going on lately. And as part of that, I recollected that Orlo had been thrown back once, and that he was out there, somewhere, extramuros, trying to find his way. Which made me sad, and even brought back a spark of the old anger. But none of it stopped me from being happy with my friends. Part of this was the sheer thrill of what had happened with Ayla. But part of it, too, was the growing certainty that Ayla and Tullia and I had scored a victory over those like Spellicon and Trestinus, who had locked us out of the Starhenge and tried to control what we knew and what we thought about. We just needed to find a way to announce it that wouldn't lead to my getting thrown back. I didn't want to leave the Consent anymore. Not as long as Ayla lived here. She and Tullia were nowhere to be seen, and before long we found out why. They had duties in the minster. Bells began to ring not long after we had finished eating. We sat and listened for a couple of minutes, trying to decipher the changes. But Barb had been memorizing these things and figured it out first.
"Voko," he announced. "The secular power will evoke one of us."
"Apparently Frau Paflagon couldn't get the job done," Jessery cracked, as we were draining our beers. "Or he's calling for reinforcements," Leo suggested. "Or he had a heart attack," said Arcibald.
Lately, he had been full of gloomy ideas like this, and so the rest of us gave him dirty looks until he held up his hands in submission. We sauntered across the meadow to the minster. Even so, we got there in plenty of time and ended up in the front row, closest to the screen.
Voko continued ringing for some minutes after we arrived. Then the eight ringers filed down from their balcony and found places farther back. A choir of hundreders came out into the chancel and began a monophonic chant. I thought of going back to be near Ayla, but it was part of the discipline that you didn't engage in any of that clingy, couple-like behavior before your liaison was published, so it would have to wait for a few more hours. This time, Statho didn't have any inquisitors with him, as he had had during Frau Paflagon's voco. He went through the opening rounds of the rite as before, and for the first time since the bells had begun to ring, it sank in that this was for real. I wondered which avowed we would say goodbye to. Whether it would be one of us tenors this time, or someone like Frau Paflagon whom we'd never met because they were of a different math. By the time Statho reached the place in the aught where he was to call out the name of the evoked, I had become quite anxious. The minster was as silent as that sub-basement beneath Schuf's dowment. So I almost wanted to scream when he chose that moment to pause and fumble around in his vestment. He took out a page that had been folded in on itself and sealed shut with a dollop of beeswax. It took him forever to pick the thing open. He unfolded it, held it up in front of his face, and looked astonished. It was such an awkward moment that even he felt the need to explain. He announced,
"There are six names."
Pandemonium was the wrong word to describe a few hundred avowed standing still and muttering to each other, but it conveys the right feeling. A single voco was rare enough. Six at a stroke had never happened. Or had it? I looked at Arcibald. He read my mind.
"No,"
he whispered.
"Not even for the big nugget."
I looked at Jessery.
"This is it,"
he told me, meaning the something different he'd been waiting for. Statho cleared his throat and waited for the murmuring to subside.
"Six names,"
he went on. The minster now became silent again, except for the faint wail of police sirens outside the day gate and the rumble of engines.
"One of them is no longer among us."
"Orlo,"
I said. About 100 others said it at the same time. Statho's face reddened.
"Voko,"
he called, but his voice choked up and he had to swallow before trying it again.
"Voko, Frau Jessery of the Adharian chapter of the Decenarian Math."
Jessery turned and socked me on the shoulder, hard enough to leave a charley horse that would still ache 3 days later. Something to remember him by. Then he turned his back on us and walked out of our lives.
"Sir Bethela of the Adharian chapter of the Centenarian Math, Fra Athafrax of the same, Fra Gorodon of the Adharian chapter of the Decenarian Math, and Sir Ayla of the New Circle, Decenarians."
By the time I had regained consciousness, she was already on the threshold of the door through the screen. She was as shocked as I was. Tears began to run out of her eyes as she hesitated there and looked my way.
When I had watched Frau Paphlagon step out all those months ago, I had understood clearly that no one in this place would ever see him again. The same thing was now happening to Suhaila. But it didn't sink in. The only thing that got through to me was the look on her face. They told me later I knocked two people down as I made my way over to her. She hooked an elbow over my neck and kissed me on the lips, then pressed her wet cheek against mine for an instant. When Frau Metaxin closed the door between us, I looked down to discover a rolled-up page stuck in my bolt. It was perforated with tiny holes. By the time I'd finished taking that in and stepped forward to put my face to the screen, Jessery and Bethula, Athafrax, Gorodin, and Ayla had already walked out the same way that Paphlagon and Orlo had gone before. Everyone was singing, except for me.
Terrible events. A worldwide catastrophe, poorly documented, but generally assumed to have been the fault of humans, that terminated the Praxic Age and led immediately to the Reconstitution. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
You see what I mean?
Leo said.
That is so crazy you wouldn't have believed me unless I showed it to you in a book.
He and I, Arcibald, Tullia, and Barb, were all sitting around the big table at Schuf's Dowment. Praxic Age exoatmospheric weapon systems was sprawled out like an autopsy. We were looking at a double-ended foldout. It had taken us a quarter of an hour just to get the thing unfurled without tearing the ancient leaves. Real paper made in a factory. We were looking at a huge, exquisitely detailed diagram of a spaceship. At one end, it sported a proper nose cone, as a rocket should. Everything else about it looked weird. It did not have engines, per se. At the aft end, where the nozzle bells of a proper rocket ought to be, there was instead a broad, flat disc, looking like a pedestal on which the vessel might be stood upright. Forward of that were several stout columns that ran up to what I assumed was the spaceship proper, the family of rounded pressure vessels sheltered beneath that nose cone.
Shock absorbers,
Leo said, pointing to the columns.
Except bigger.
He drew our attention to a tiny hole in the center of the big disc astern.
This is where it would spit out the atomic bombs, one after another.
That's the part I still can't get my mind to accept.
Have you ever heard of those deolaters who walk barefoot over hot coals to show that they have supernatural powers?
He looked over toward the hearth. We had lit a fire there. Not that we needed one. We had a couple of windows cracked open to admit a fresh, green-scented breeze that was blowing in over the young clover in the meadow. Sad songs were carried on that air. Most of the avowed were so shocked by the sixfold voco that to make music about it was all that they could do. Those of us in this room had another way to come to terms with our loss, but only because we knew things that the others didn't. We had lit the fire as soon as we had arrived, not to keep warm, but as a primitive way to get some comfort. It was what humans had done long before Canoas, long before even language, to claim a bit of space in a dark universe that they did not understand and that was wont to claim their family and friends suddenly and forever. Leo went over to that fire and assaulted a glowing log with a poker until he had knocked off several lumps of glowing charcoal. He raked one of these out onto the stones. It was about the size of a nut and red hot. I was already getting nervous.
Raz, he said, would you put this in your pocket and carry it around?
I don't have pockets, I joked.
No one laughed.
Sorry, I said. No, if I had a pocket, I would not put that into it.
Leo spat into the palm of his left hand, then put the fingertips of his right into the pool of saliva. He then used them to pick up that coal. There were sizzling noises. We cringed. He calmly tossed the coal back into the fire, then slapped his hot fingertips against his thigh a few times.
"Slight discomfort, no damage," he announced. "The noise was spit being vaporized by the heat of the coal. Now imagine that the plate on the back of that ship was coated with something that served the same purpose."
"The same purpose as spit?" Barb asked.
"Yes. It was vaporized by the plasma from the atomic bombs, and as it expanded into space, it would spank that plate. The shock absorbers would even out the impact and turn it into steady thrust, so that the people up at the forward end would feel nice, smooth acceleration."
"It's just hard to imagine being that close to an atomic bomb going off," Tullia said. "And not just one, but a whole series of them."
Her voice sounded pretty raw. All of ours did, except for Barb's. He'd been perusing the book earlier.
"They were special bombs, really tiny," he said,
making a circle of his arms to show their size.
"Designed not to blow out in all directions, but to spew a lot of plasma in one direction toward that ship."
"I, too, find it unfathomable," Archibald volunteered. "But I vote we suspend our disbelief and move forward. The evidence is before us in this,"
he gestured toward the book,
"and this."
He rested his hand on the sheet that Ayla had pinpricked the day before. Then he looked stricken. I think he had seen something on my face, or Tullia's, or both. For us, this leaf was now like one of the mementos of bygone saunts that the avowed cherished in reliquaries.
"Perhaps," Archibald said, "it is too early for us to have this discussion. Perhaps—"
"Perhaps it's too late," I said, which earned me a grateful look from Tullia and seemed to settle it for everyone.
"I'm surprised, pleasantly, you're here at all, Archibald," I said.
"You are referring to my apparent skittishness of recent weeks?"
"Your words, not mine," I said, working to keep a straight face. He raised his eyebrows.
"I do not recall, do you, any diktat from the hierarchs to the effect that we must not make tiny holes in pieces of foil and allow the light of the sun to fall on paper? Our position is unassailable."
"I hadn't thought of it that way," I said. "I almost feel a little let down that we are no longer breaking any rules."
"I know it must be an odd sensation for you, Frau Erasmus, but you may get used to it after a while."
Barb didn't get the joke. We had to explain it. He still didn't get it.
"So I wonder if, perhaps, one of these ships went missing," Tullia said.
"Went missing?"
Leo repeated.
"Like its crew mutinied and they headed out for parts unknown. Now, thousands of years later, their descendants have returned."
"It might not even be their descendants,"
Archibald pointed out.
"Because of relativity,"
Barb exclaimed.
"That's right," I said.
"Come to think of it, if the ship could travel at relativistic velocity, they might have gone on a round-trip journey that lasted a few decades to them, but thousands of years to us." Everyone loved this hypothesis. We had already made up our minds it must be true. There was only one problem.
"None of these ships was ever built," Leo said.
"What?" He looked as if we were about to blame him for it.
"It was just a proposal. These are nothing more than conceptual drawings from very late in the Praxic Age."
"Just before the terrible events,"
Barb footnoted. We were all silent for a while. It takes time and effort to tear down and stow away an idea you were that excited about.
"Besides," Leo went on, "this ship was only for military operations inside the solar system. They had ideas for ones that could go to relativistic velocity, but they would have been much bigger, and they'd have looked different."
"You wouldn't need a nose cone,"
said Barb, which was his idea of hilarious.
"So if we buy the idea that what Ayla and I saw, the Blue Sparker, was a ship in orbit that was using this kind of propulsion system,"
I began, nodding at the diagram.
"Then it must have come from an alien civilization,"
Archibald said.
"Fra Jesri believes that advanced life forms must be extremely rare in the universe,"
Barb told us.
"He followed the conjecture of Saint Mandarast,"
Archibald said, nodding agreement.
Billions of planets infested with unicellular glop, almost none with multicellular organisms, to say nothing of civilizations.
Let's speak of him in the present tense. It's not as though he's dead, Tullia pointed out.
I stand corrected, said Arcibald,
none too wholeheartedly.
Barb, when you were talking to Jessery of this, did he have some alternate theory?
Tullia asked.
Yes, an alternate theory about an alternate universe,
Barb cracked. Tullia mussed his hair and gave him a shove, which was a mistake because then he wanted to get rambunctious. We had to threaten him with anathem and make him go outside and run 5 laps around Schuf's Diamond before he would settle down.
Talking about where this thing might have come from is a sidetrack to the main discussion,
Leo pointed out.
Agreed,
said Arcibald, so authoritatively that we did agree.
It came from somewhere. Who cares? It settled into a polar orbit around Arb and stayed there for a while.
Doing what? I said.
Reconnaissance,
said Leo.
That's what polar orbits are for.
So they were learning about us, mapping Arb, eavesdropping on our communications, learning our language,
Tullia said. I went on.
Somehow Orlo became aware of it. Maybe he happened to see the deceleration burn that took it into polar orbit. Perhaps others did too. The Pangendrums knew. They sent word to the hierarchs. We are putting you on notice that we deem this to be a secular matter. It is none of your business, so butt out. And the hierarchs dutifully sent out the order to close every Starhenge.
Inquisitors were sent to make sure it was done,
Leo said.
Fra Paphlagon was evoked to go somewhere and study this thing,
Tullia said.
He,
said Arcibald,
and perhaps others like him from other consents.
The ship stayed in orbit. Maybe sometimes it would adjust its trajectory by firing those engines, but it would only do so when it was passing between Arb and the sun, to hide its traces.
Like a fugitive who walks in a river not to leave footprints,
Barb put in.
But yesterday something changed. Something big must have happened.
Gardan Steelyard says that the course change you and Ayla witnessed and the unprecedented 6-fold voco less than a day later must be connected,
Arcibald said.
I had been avoiding the sacred relic.
That had to end. Ayla had given it to me for a reason. We unrolled it on the table and weighed its corners down with books.
We can't figure out what it did unless we know the darn geometry,
Barb complained.
You mean of the pinhole and where the screen was situated up in the presidium? Which way was up, which way was north, I said.
I agree that we have to take all of those measurements.
Barb started backing toward the exit, ready to take those measurements at once. But I held back. I wanted to do those things as badly as he did. But here was where Orlo would have proposed something brilliantly simple. Something that would have made me feel like an idiot for having made it too complicated. I could think of nothing like that.
Why don't we at least measure the angle, I said. It comes in from one direction. That's its initial orbit. By firing those bombs, it curves until it is going a different direction. That's its final orbit. We could at least measure that angle. So we did. The answer was something like a quarter of pi, 45 degrees.
So if we assume it started out in a polar orbit, then by the time this maneuver was finished, it was in a new orbit, roughly halfway between polar and equatorial,
Leo said.
And what do you suppose would be the point of that? I asked.
Since Leo knew so much more of exo-atmospheric weapon systems than anyone else in the room.
If you plot its ground track on a globe or a map of the world, well, it's never going to ascend higher than 45 degrees of latitude in such an orbit. It'll sine wave back and forth between 45 degrees north and 45 south.
Which is where 99% of the people live. Tullia pointed out.
Which they would know by now, since they have had time to compile maps of every square inch of Arb,
Arcibald reminded us.
They have finished phase 1, reconnaissance,
Leo concluded.
And yesterday began phase 2, which is, who knows?
Actually doing something,
Barb said. And the Panjandrums know it, I said. Have been worrying about it. They've had a contingency plan ready for months. We know this because Orlo's name was on that list. So it must have been written out and sealed before his anathem.
I'll bet Varax and O'Nally handed it to Statho during Appert, Tullia said. Statho's been carrying it around ever since, awaiting the signal to break the seal and read out those names.
She got a distracted look on her face.
It bothers me that they chose Ayla.
I never fully understood until last week how close the two of you were, I said.
But Tullia wanted none of it.
It's not just that, she said. I mean, it is. I love her. I can't stand that she's gone, but why her? Paphlagon, Orlo, Jezri, fine, I get it. But why would you choose Ayla? What would you want someone like her for?
To organize a lot of other people,
Arcibald said without hesitation.
That, said Tullia, is what troubles me.
For God's sake, raise your sights. Mention of the Inquisitors had put me in mind of the conversation I'd had with Varax on 10th night. This had slipped my mind because of what had happened a few moments afterwards, but I could remember him gazing up at the Starhenge. Or perhaps he'd been raising his sights a little higher, looking off into space. Come to think of it, he'd been facing north at the time. Larger matters are at stake than whether a young Fra at the remote hermitage of Sant Edhar practices his vlore on some local renegades. Think bigger, the way your friend does when he decides to tackle four larger men.
What on earth did that mean?
That the alien ship was a threat? That we would soon have to tackle it against long odds? Or was I reading too much into it? And why, during my earlier conversation with Varax, had he grilled me concerning my opinions on the Hylaean theoric world? It was an odd time for someone like him to be so concerned with metatheorics. Or maybe I was reading way too much into these conversations. Maybe Varax was just one of those guys who thought out loud. The raise your sights part of it seemed pretty clear. I didn't need a lot of encouragement to get to work. After Orlo's anathem, the only thing that had kept me from going crazy had been working on the photomnemonic tablet. Ayla's loss wasn't quite as dreadful. At least she hadn't been thrown back. But unlike Orlo's, it had been entirely surprising to me. I was still feeling bad that I had just stood there like a stunned animal while she had walked out of my life. To have lost her, just after we had begun something. Well, suffice it to say that I really needed a project to work on. Our group invaded the shack above the belfry with every measuring device we could scare up. Arcibald found some architectural drawings of the minster dating back to the 4th century. We calculated the geometry of the camera obscura in three different ways and compared the results until we got them all to agree. We were able to refine the rough measurement we had made at Schuf's Dalmond. The ship's new orbit was inclined at about 51 degrees to the equator, which meant that it passed over essentially all populated areas. When the weather had become hot and dry in the centuries after the terrible events, people had tended to move poleward. More recently, reductions in the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere had begun to gentle the climate, and people had migrated back towards the equator to get away from the solar radiation near the poles. As a matter of fact, 51 degrees was a higher orbit than the ship really needed, if all it wanted was to keep an eye on most of the world's population. We thought this mysterious until Arcibald pointed out that if you looked at all the world's major continents, meaning ones that had millennium clocks and that housed hundreds or thousands of avout, the one that was farthest from the equator was at 51.3 degrees north latitude. That one happened to be the remote hermitage of Sant Edhar. Word got around. Within a month of the big Voco, everyone in the Decenarian Math knew most of what we knew about the ship. The Hierarchs made no effort to suppress it, but they didn't open the Starhenge either. I found myself getting invited to a lot more late-night chalk hall sessions. We studied the diagram Leo had found in that book and worked out the theorics of how such a ship would function and how much bigger it would have to be to journey between stars. Some of it was simple praxic calculations about the shock absorbers.
Some, such as predicting what the plasma would do when it hit the plate, was extraordinarily challenging work. The Theorix was too advanced for me. It felt like we were proving the Lorites wrong because some of the other avowed, just a little older than I, were coming up with proofs that we were pretty sure had never been thought of by anyone before. Anyone on Arb, that is.
"It makes you wonder about the Hylian Theoric world," Archibald volunteered one summer evening, about 8 weeks after the big voco. He had been pretending to look after his bees, and I had been pretending to tend the weeds.
By that time, the Sarthian cavalry had penetrated deep into the plains of Thrania and driven a wedge between the 4th and the 33rd legions of General Oxus. So it wasn't surprising that Archibald and I bumped into each other. At our latitude, days were very long at this time of year, and we still had some light remaining even though supper had ended hours ago.
"What's on your mind?" I asked him.
"You are toiling in chalk halls with the other Edharians, trying to work out the theorics of this alien ship," he said. "Theorics that the aliens must have mastered long ago to build such a thing and drive it among stars. My question is, are they the same theorics?"
"You mean ours and the aliens?"
"Yes." "I see the chalk dust on your bolt, Fra Erasmus, from equations you were drawing after supper. Did some two-headed, eight-limbed alien draw the same equations on the equivalent of a slate on another planet 1,000 years ago?
"I'm pretty sure the aliens used different notation," I began.
"Obviously,"
he barked. "You sound like Ayla."
"Maybe they use a little square to represent multiplication and a circle for division or something," he went on, rolling his eyes in annoyance, then whirling his hand to indicate he wanted the conversation to go faster.
"Or maybe they don't write out equations at all," I said. "Maybe they prove things with music or something."
Which wasn't far-fetched at all, since we did something like that in our chants, and there had been whole orders of avowed who had done all of their theorics that way.
"Now we're getting somewhere."
He was so thrilled by this idea that I regretted having mentioned it.
"Suppose they have a system of doing theorics that uses music, as you said, and perhaps, if it leads to a harmonious chord or a pleasing tune, it means that they have proved that something is true."
"You really are going off the deep end now, Archibald."
"Tolerate your friend and Fra."
"Do you think it's the case that for every proof you and the other Edharians work out on a slate, the aliens have a proof in their own system that corresponds to it, that says the same thing, expresses the same truth?" "We couldn't do theorics at all if we didn't think that was the case."
"But Archibald, this is old stuff we're talking about. Canoas saw it. Hylia understood it. Protus formalized it. Paphlagon thought about it, which is why he got evoked. What's the point of going over it now? I'm tired. As soon as it gets a little darker, I'm going to bed."
"How are we to communicate with the aliens?"
"I don't know." "It's been speculated that they have been learning our language," I reminded him.
"What if they can't talk?"
"A minute ago you had them singing."
"Don't be tedious, Fra Erasmus. You know what I'm getting at."
"Maybe I do, but it's late.
I was up until 3 talking about plasma. Hey, I think it is dark enough for me to go to bed now. Hear me out. I'm saying that it is through the proton forms, the theoric truths, in the Hylian theoric world that we might end up communicating with them."
"It sounds like you're just itching for an excuse to barricade yourself and Schiff's Dalmet behind a stack of old books and work on this. Are you asking me for permission? Approval?"
He shrugged.
"You are the resident expert on the alien ship."
"Okay, fine. Knock yourself out. I'll back you up. I'll tell everyone you're not crazy."
"Capital.
If you help me with one thing that really has me scratching my head right now."
"And what would that be, Fra Erasmus?"
"Why does the millenarian math appear to be glowing?"
"What?"
"Look at it," I said. He turned around and raised his chin to gaze up at the crag. It was glowing ruby red. This was not a normal thing for it to be doing. Of course, we saw soft lights up there all the time, and if the weather was right, the walls would sometimes catch the light of the setting sun, as when Orlo and I had looked on it during Appert. For the last few minutes, as the twilight had been deepening, I had noticed a red glow about the place, and reckoned it must be that again. But the sun was absolutely down now, and this light was a shade of red that was most unsunlike. It had a grainy, sparkly quality. and it was coming from the wrong direction. Sunlight would have lit up the west-facing surfaces of the map and the crag. But this weird red light was striking the roofs, parapets, and tower tops. Everything below was in shade. It was almost as if some aircraft was hovering high above the crag, shining a light straight down. But if that were the case, it was so high we could neither see nor hear it. The meadow grew busy with Fras and Sewers who came out of the cloister buildings to look at it. Most were silent, like deolaters gazing upon a heavenly omen. But among a group of theoricians not far away, an argument was gaining momentum, featuring words such as laser, color, and wavelength. That jogged my memory. I knew where I'd seen that grainy sort of light before. The guide star lasers on the M&M. And that was the key to the riddle. A laser beam could shine across a vast distance without spreading out very much. The thing that was shining this light on the millenarian map didn't have to be nearby. It could be thousands of miles away. It could be, could only be, the alien spaceship. Exclamations and even a little bit of applause rose up from the meadow. Looking more closely at the millenarian map, I saw that a column of smoke was rising from behind its walls. I swallowed hard and got very upset for just a moment, thinking that the laser was setting fire to the place. It was a death ray. Then my better sense got the upper hand. To burn things down, one would want an infrared laser, whose light would make things hot. By definition, this laser wasn't infrared because we could see it. The smoke wasn't from burning buildings. The Thousanders were creating it. They were throwing grass or something onto fires, filling the space above their map with smoke and steam. It was impossible to see a laser beam from the side if it was traversing empty space or clean air, but if you put smoke or dust in its way, the particles would scatter some of the light in all directions and make the ray stand out as a glittering line in space. It worked. That ray might be thousands of miles long. We'd never be able to see most of it, the part that traversed the vacuum above the atmosphere. But the smoke made by the Thousanders enabled us to see the last few hundred feet and to get a very good idea of which direction the light was coming from. And of course, I had an unfair advantage since I knew the plane of the alien ship's orbit, which of the fixed stars it would pass in front of. I held my bolt up with one hand, making a screen to block out most of the light from the crag. My eyes adjusted to the dark, to the point where I could see the stars again. And then I saw it arcing across the sky, just where I knew it'd be. A point of red light, surrounded by a grainy nimbus caused by its passage through the atmosphere. I pointed. Others around me saw this and found it for themselves. The meadow became as silent as the minster during an anathem. The shooting star winked out and vanished into the black. The red glow was gone. A round of applause started up in the meadow, but it was tentative, nervous. It died away before it really got going.
"I feel like a fool," Archibald said.
He turned and looked at me.
"When I think of all the things I've worried about and been afraid of in my life, and now it's plain that I've been scared of the wrong things."
They rang Voco at 3 o'clock in the morning. No one minded the odd hour. No one was sleeping anyway. People showed up slow and late because most of them were carrying books and other things they thought they might need, supposing their names were called. Statho evoked 17.
"Leo, Tullia, Erasmus, Archibald,
Taverner,"
and some other tenors. I stepped over the threshold into the chancel, a step I had taken thousands of times to wind the clock. But when I wound the clock, I always knew that a few minutes later, Fra Taxon would open the door again. This time I turned my back on 300 faces I'd never see again, unless they got evoked and sent to, well, wherever I was being sent. I found myself with several I knew well and some who were strangers to me. Hundreders.
The intonation of the names stopped. I reckoned we were finished, and looked at Statho, expecting him to move on to the next phase of the aught. He was staring at the list in his hand. His expression was difficult to read. His face and body had gone stiff. He blinked slowly and shifted the list toward the nearest candle as if having trouble reading it. He seemed to be scanning the same line over and over. Finally, he forced himself to raise his gaze and looked directly across the chancel at the millenarian's screen.
"Foco,"
he said, but it came out husky and he had to clear his throat.
"Loco Fra Jad of the Millenarians."
Everything got quiet. Or maybe it was blood raging in my ears. There was a long wait. Then the door in the Thousander's screen creaked open to reveal the silhouette of an old Fra. He stood there for a moment, waiting for the dust to clear. That door didn't get open very often. Then he stepped out into the chancel. Someone closed the door behind him. Statho said a few more words to formally evoke us. We said the words to answer the call. The avowed behind the screens took up their anthem of mourning and farewell. All of them sang their hearts out. The Thousanders shook the minster with a mighty, croaking bass line so deep you felt more than heard it. That, even more than the singing of my Decenarian family, made the hairs prickle on my scalp, made my nose run and my eyes sting. The Thousanders were going to miss Fra Jad, and they were making sure he knew it in his bones. I looked straight up, just as Paphlagon and Orlo had. The light of the candles only penetrated a short distance up the well, but I wasn't really doing this in an attempt to see something. I was doing it to prevent a deluge from running out of my nostrils and my eyes. The others were moving around me. I lowered my chin to see what was happening. A junior hierarch was leading us out.
"There's a hypothesis, you know, that we just get taken to a gas chamber now," Arcibald muttered.
"Shut up," I said. Not wanting to hear any more in this vein from him, I lingered and let him go well ahead of me, which took a while since he had made half of his bolt into a sack and was lugging a small library. The hierarchs, all formally robed in purple, led us down the center aisle of the empty north nave and from there to the narthex just inside the day gate. We congregated below the great orrery. The day gate had been opened, but the plaza beyond was empty. No aircraft was waiting for us there. No buses, not even a pair of roller skates. Junior hierarchs were circulating through the group handing things out. I got a shopping bag from a local department store. Inside were a pair of dungarees, a shirt, drawers, socks, and on the bottom, a pair of walking shoes. A minute later, I was handed a knapsack. Inside was a water bottle, a poly bag containing toiletries, and a money card. There was also a wristwatch. It took me a while to understand why. Once we got more than a couple of miles from San Edhar, we'd have no way of knowing the time. Sir Trestinus addressed us.
"Your destination is the consent of Sant Tredegar," she announced.
"Is it a convox?" someone asked.
"It is now," she answered.
This killed all discussion for a minute as everyone absorbed that news.
"How are we to get there?" Tullia asked. "Any way you can," said Trestinus.
"What?" That, or some variation of it, came from all of the evoked at once. Part of the romance of Voco, a small consolation for being ripped away from everyone you knew, was that you got whisked away in some kind of vehicle, as Fra Paphlagon had been, instead of which we'd been issued walking shoes.
"You are not to wear the bolt and the cord under the open sky, night or day," Trestinus went on. "Spheres are to be kept fist-sized or smaller and not used to make light. You are not to walk out of this gate altogether. We'll have you emerge in groups of two or three. Later, if you want, you can meet up somewhere, away from the consent, preferably underneath something."
"What is the resolution of their surveillance?" Leo asked.
"We have no idea."
"Sant Tredegar's is 2,000 miles away,"
Barb mentioned, in case this was of interest, which it was. There are local organizations connected with ARCs that are trying to round up vehicles and drivers to get you there.
Warden of Heaven people?
Arcibald asked. He beat me to it. Some of them, Trestinus said.
No thanks, someone called out. One of those people tried to convert me during Appert. Her arguments were pathetic.
Ho, 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 went someone very close to me. I turned and looked. It was Fra Jad, standing behind me with his shopping bag and his knapsack. He wasn't laughing that loudly, so no one else had noticed him. He smelled like smoke. He had not bothered to look into the shopping bag yet. He saw my head turn and looked me in the eye, very amused.
"The powers that be must be pissing their pants," he said, "or whatever they wear nowadays."
Everyone else was too stunned by all that had happened to say much. Here I had an advantage. I had gotten used to being stunned, like Leo was used to being punched in the head. I climbed up onto a stone bench that had been placed where visitors could sit on it and watch the orrery. "South of the consent, not far from the Century Gate, west of the river, there's a great roof on stilts that straddles a canal. Next to it is a machine hall. You can't miss it. It's the biggest structure in the neighborhood by far. We can meet there undercover. Go there in small groups like Sura Trustinus said. We'll convene there later and come up with a plan."
"What time shall we meet?"
asked one of the hundreders. I considered it. "Let's meet when we, I mean when they, ring provener."
Part 6. Peregrine.
Peregrine. 1. In ancient usage, the epic beginning with the destruction of the Temple of Orithena in -2621 and ending several decades later with the flourishing of the Golden Age of Ethras. 2. A Fëanor who survived Orithena and wandered about the ancient world, sometimes alone and sometimes in the company of other such. 3. A dialogue supposedly dating to this epic. Many were later written down and incorporated into the literature of the Mafic world. 4. In modern usage, an avowt who, under certain exceptional circumstances, leaves the confines of the math and travels through the secular world while trying to observe the spirit, if not the letter, of the discipline. The Dictionary. 4th edition. AR 3000.
We took turns going into the men's and women's toilet chambers to change. The shoes immediately drove me crazy. I kicked them off and parked them under a bench, then found a clear place on the narthex floor where I could spread out my bolt and fold it up. That involved stooping and squatting, tricky in dungarees. I couldn't believe people wore this stuff their whole lives. Once I had my bolt reduced to a book-sized package, I wrapped my cord around it, put them into the department store bag along with my balled-up sphere, and stuffed that into the bottom of the knapsack. Across the narthex, Leo was trying to perform some of his Valor moves in his new clothes. He moved as if he had just come down with a neurological disorder. Tullia's clothes didn't fit at all, and she was negotiating a swap with one of the centenarian sewers. Is this a convox? It is now. There had only been 8 convoxes. The first had coincided with the reconstitution. After that, one had been held at each millennium to compile the edition of the dictionary that would be used for the next 1,000 years and to take care of other business of concern to the thousanders. There had been one for the big nugget and one at the end of each sack. Barb became jumpy, then unruly, and then wild. None of the hierarchs knew what to make of him. "He doesn't like change," Tullia reminded me. "The unspoken message, he's your friend. He's your problem." Barb didn't like being crowded either, so Leo and I crowded him. We crowded him into a corner where Archibald was encamped with his stack of books.
Voco breaks the discipline because the one evoked goes forth alone and from that point onwards is immersed in the secular world, Archibald intoned. That's why they can't return. Convox is different. So many of us are taken at once that we can travel together and preserve the discipline within our Peregrine group.
Peregrine begins and ends at a math, Barb said, suddenly calm.
Yes, Fra Taverner.
When we get to St. Tredegar's,
we'll celebrate the Odd of Inbrace, Archibald prompted him. And?
And then we'll be together with other Avout in the Convox, Barb guessed.
And then?
And then when we're done doing whatever it is they want us to do, we make Peregrine back to St. Edhar, Barb went on.
Yes, Fra Taverner, said Archibald.
I could sense him fending off the temptation to add, if we haven't been incinerated by an alien death ray or gassed by the Warden of Heaven.
Barb calmed down. It wouldn't last. Once we left the day gate, we'd be contending with minor violations of the discipline all the time. Barb would be certain to notice these and point them out.
Why, oh, why had he been evoked? He was just a brand new Fid. I was going to be babysitting him through the entire Convox.
As the small hours of the morning passed, though, and the lapis sphere that represented Arb and the orrery ticked slowly around, I settled down a little bit and remembered that half of what I now knew about Theorix was thanks to Barb. What would it say about me if I ditched him? It was getting light outside. Half of the evoked had already departed. The hierarchs were pairing tenors with hundreders because many of the latter would need help from the former in speaking fluckish and coping with the seculum in general. Leo was summoned and went out with a couple of hundreders. Archibald and Tullia were told to get ready. I couldn't go out barefoot. My shoes were under a bench by the orrery. Fra Jad had parked himself on that bench, right above my shoes. His head was bent. His hands were folded in his lap. He must be doing some kind of profound thousander meditation. If I disturbed him just so that I could fetch my shoes, he would turn me into a newt or something. No one else wanted to disturb him either. Tullia, then Archibald, left with hundreders in tow. There were only three evoked left, Barb, Jad, and I. Jad was still in his bolt and cord. Barb headed for Fra Jad. I broke into a sprint and caught up with him just as he arrived.
Fra Jad must change clothes, Barb announced,
stretching his first year orth until it cracked. Fra Jad looked up. Until now, I had thought that his hands were folded together in his lap. Now I saw that he was holding a disposable razor still encased in its colorful package. I had one just like it in my bag. It was a common brand. Fra Jad was reading the label. The big characters were kinograms, which he would never have seen before, but the fine print was in the same alphabet that we used.
What principle explains the powers imputed by this document to the Dynaglide Lubristrip? He asked. Is it permanent or ablative?
Ablative, I said.
It is a violation of the discipline for you to be reading that, Barb complained.
Shut up, Fra Jad said.
I don't mean in any way to be disrespectful, I tried after a somewhat awkward and lengthy pause, but
is it time to leave?
Fra Jad asked, and checked the orrery as if it were a wristwatch. Yes. Fra Jad stood up and, in the same motion, stripped his bolt off over his head. Some of the hierarchs gasped and turned their backs. Nothing happened for a little while. I rummaged in his shopping bag and found a pair of drawers, which I handed to him.
Do I need to explain this? I asked, pointing out the fly.
Fra Jad took the garment from me and discovered how the fly worked.
Topology is destiny, he said,
and put the drawers on, one leg at a time. It was hard to estimate his age. His skin was loose and mottled, but he balanced perfectly on one leg, then the other, as he put on the drawers.
The rest of getting Frajad decent went by without notable incidents. I retrieved my shoes and tried once more to remember how to tie them. Barb seemed amazingly content to follow the command to shut up. I wondered why I had never tried this simple tactic with him before. Stumbling and shuffling in our shoes, hitching our trousers up from time to time, we walked out the day gate. The plaza was empty. We crossed the causeway between the twin fountains and entered into the burgers' town. An old market had stood there until I'd been about 6 years old, when the authorities had renamed it the Old Market, destroyed it, and built a new market devoted to selling t-shirts and other objects with pictures of the old market. Meanwhile, the people who had operated the little stalls in the old market had gone elsewhere and set up a thing on the edge of town that was now called the New Market, even though it was actually the old market. Some casinos had gone up around the older market, hoping to cater to people who wanted to visit it or who had business of one kind or another linked to the consent. But no one wanted to visit an older market that was surrounded by casinos, and frankly, the consent wasn't that much of an attraction, so the casinos were looking dirty and forlorn. Sometimes at night we could hear music playing from dance halls in their basements, but they were awfully quiet at the moment.
"We can obtain breakfast in there," Barb said.
"Casino restaurants are expensive," I demurred.
"They have a breakfast buffet that you can go to for free. My father and I would eat there sometimes."
This made me sad, but I could not dispute the logic, so I followed Barb, and Jad followed me. The casino was a labyrinth of corridors that all looked the same. They saved money by keeping the lights dim and not washing the carpets. The mildew made us sneeze. We ended up in a windowless room below ground. Fleshy men, smelling like soap, sat alone or in pairs at tables. There was nothing to read. A spiele display was mounted to the wall, showing feeds of news, weather, and sports. It was the first moving picture praxis that Frajad had ever seen, and it took him some getting used to. Barb and I let him stare at it while we got food from the buffet. We put our trays down on a table, and then I returned to Frajad, who was watching highlights of a ball game. A man at a nearby table was trying to draw him into conversation about one of the teams. Frajad's t-shirt happened to be emblazoned with the logo of the same team, and this had caused the man to jump to a whole set of wrong conclusions. I got between Frajad's face and the spiele and managed to break his concentration, then led him over to the buffet. Thousanders didn't eat much meat because there wasn't room to raise livestock on their crag. He seemed eager to make up for lost time. I tried to steer him toward cereal products, but he knew what he wanted. While we were eating, a newsfeed came up on the spiele showing a mathic stone tower seen from a distance at night, lit from above by a grainy red glow. The scene was very much like what the Thousanders' Math had looked like last night, but the building on the feed was not one that I had ever seen.
"That is the Millenarian Spire in the Consent of St. Rambolf," Frajad announced. "I have seen drawings of it."
St. Rambolf's was on another continent. We knew little of it because it had no orders in common with ours. I'd run across the name recently, but I could not remember exactly where.
"One of the three inviolates," Barb said.
"Is that what you call us?"
Jad asked.
Barb was right.
The Flying Wedge Monument inside our year gate bore a plaque telling the story of the third sack and mentioning the 3,000-er maths in all the world that had not been violated. St. Edhar, St. Rambolf, and
St. Tredegar is the third,
Barb continued. As if the spiele were responding to his voice, we now saw an image of a map that seemed to have been carved into the face of a stone bluff. It, too, was illuminated from above by red light.
"That's odd," I said.
"Why would the aliens shine the light on the three inviolates? That is ancient history."
"They are telling us something," said Fra Jad.
"What are they telling us? That they're really interested in the history of the third sack?"
"No," said Fra Jad. "They are probably telling us that they have figured out that Edhar, Rambolf, and Tredegar are where the secular power stored all of the nuclear waste."
I was glad we were speaking Orth. We walked to a fueling station on the main road out of town, and I bought a cartabla. They had them in different sizes and styles. The one I bought was about the size of a book. Its corners and edges were decorated with thick, knobby pads, meant to look like the tires of off-road vehicles. That's because this cartabla was meant for people who liked that kind of thing. It contained topographic maps. Ordinary cartablas had different decorations, and they only showed roads and shopping centers. When we got outside, I turned it on. After a few seconds, it flashed up an error message, and then defaulted to a map of the whole continent. It didn't indicate our position as it ought to have done. "Hey," I said to the attendant, back inside. "This thing's busted." "No, it's not." "Yes, it is. It can't fix our position." "Oh, none of them can today. Believe me, your cartabla works fine. Hey, it's showing you the map, isn't it?"
"Yeah, but..."
"He's right,"
said another customer, a driver who had just pulled into the station in a long-range Drummond.
"The satellites are on the blink. Mine can't get a fix. No one's can."
He chuckled.
"You just picked the wrong morning to buy a new cartabla."
"So this started last night?"
"Yeah, about 3 in the morning. Ah, don't worry. The powers that be depend on those things. Military. Can't get by without them. They'll get it all fixed in no time."
"Wonder if it has anything to do with the red lights shining on the clocks last night," I said, just to see what they might say. "I saw it on the Spiele. That's one of their festivals. It's a ritual or something they do," said the attendant. "That's what I heard." This was news to the other customer, and so I asked the attendant where he had heard it. He tapped a gee-jaw hanging on a lanyard around his neck. "Morning cast from my ark." The natural question would now have been, "Warden of Heaven?" But showing more than the weakest curiosity might have pegged me as an escapee from a consent. So I just nodded and walked out of the fueling station. Then I started to lead Barb and Jad in the direction of the machine hall. "The aliens are jamming the nav satellites," I announced.
"Or maybe they just shot them down," said Barb.
"Let's buy a sextant then,"
suggested Fra Jad.
"Those have not been made in 4,000 years, I told him. "Let's build one then."
"I have no idea of all the parts and whatnot that go into a sextant." He found this amusing.
"Neither do I. I was assuming we would design it from first principles."
"Yeah," snorted Barb. "It's just geometry, Raz."
In the present age, this continent is covered by a dense network of hard-surfaced roads replete with signs and other navigational aids, I announced.
"Oh," said Fra Jad.
"Between that and this," I waved the cartabla, "we can find our way to Sant Tredegar without having to design a sextant from first principles." Fra Jad seemed a little put out by this. A minute later, though, we happened to pass an office supply store. I ran in and bought a protractor, then handed it to Fra Jad to serve as the first component in his homemade sextant. He was deeply impressed. I realized that this was the first thing he had seen extramuros that made sense to him.
"Is that a temple of a Draconis?"
he asked, gazing at the store. "No," I said, and turned my back on it and walked away. "It is praxic. They need primitive trigonometry to build things like wheelchair ramps and doorstops."
"Nonetheless,"
he said, falling behind me and looking back longingly.
"They must have some perception."
"Fra Jad," I said, "they have no awareness of the Hylian theoric world."
"Oh, really?"
"Really. Anyone out here who begins to see into the HTW, suppresses it, goes crazy, or ends up at Sant Edhar." I turned around and looked at him. "Where did you think Barb and I came from?" Once we had gotten clear as to that, Barb and Jad were happy to follow me and discuss sextants as I led them on a wide arc around the west side of Sant Edhar to the machine hall.